G'day everybody, my name's Glenn Hill.
Jacob Meyer.
And we're here for yet another Technical Tennis podcast, post-Wimbledon.
Thanks guys so much for your patience with us. I think it's been a little while since we've recorded.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were kind of middle of Wimbledon when we did the last one, and a few things have happened since then, not just in the tennis world. I took a two-week hiatus and went to Costa Rica and surfed my butt off.
Yeah, well, obviously nothing important happened at Wimbledon, so that's why we didn't record.
Yeah, that's it. And then you were traveling. You were at Wimbledon, obviously, and then afterwards, I think you came.
I was there, yeah.
And then you went to Atlanta for the BB&T.
We had Newport in between.
Right, yeah. Newport, BB&T, and then now you are.
Now I'm where am I? Now I'm at a little challenger. Yeah.
We had
good results in Newport. I like how you try and take that one away from me.
I wasn't trying to take it away from you. I didn't know how much you want to talk about it, but. Yeah, so here we are, and Wimbledon's happened. Number 19 for Roger Federer's happened, and the 8th Wimbledon title for Mr. Federer also.
Wait, did he win that?
Yeah, that's the word on the street. So let's talk about that a little bit, because we both made some predictions heading into Wimbledon, and we made some predictions kind of halfway through the tournament.
And, should we start with you being right or with me being wrong?
Let's start with you being wrong to set the stage, and then we can talk about me being right. I like that order. So next time
I'm not going to ask you.
Yeah, just, I don't know why you do that. Yeah. That was never going to end well. So you pretty boldly predicted that Rafa was going to take the whole thing.
Yeah, and I made that prediction all the way back before the French Open. There was a very specific set of circumstances where I said, if Rafa does things a certain way, he's going to go into this French, he's going to win the French, he's going to be confident, he's going to play more aggressive, he's going to get to Wimbledon, he's going to continue to play even more aggressive, he's going to start to sense the gap closing on Federer, and that he was going to play some of the most aggressive tennis we've seen from him in years, and that he was going to sweep both the French Open and Wimbledon. And for the record, going into like the third round, I had so many people tell me just how awesome it was that my prediction was looking so good.
Yeah.
And then came Gilles Mueller.
Then came Gilles Mueller, which, you know, we talked about that match when we were forecasting that round. And, you know, I talked a bit about how I thought that Gilles was a genuine threat, that he was going to make that match really, really tough on Rafa. I wouldn't say that I predicted an upset, but I pretty adamantly said that it was very, very possible.
Nah, you did not predict an upset. I'm not giving you that one.
I'm not claiming a prediction of an upset. I did say that I thought that match was going to get very close and could go either way. And, I mean, that's really what happened. You know, Mueller just came out and served unbelievably well, executed, and got the job done.
Well, look, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Gilles is great. You know, he played well, but he didn't really – I don't think he really did anything that far out of the ordinary. I think he played his game, and his patterns match up very well for Rafa. What I really want to talk about is that Rafa went through a pretty significant response, a change almost, in that match. And to talk about that, we really have to go back to the French, where he steamrolled everyone and was playing absolutely lights out. And then if you remember the podcast from early on before Wimbledon and during the first week, he was practicing just at a level of aggression that we've never seen from him. And he was playing matches that way. His first round especially just absolutely played as aggressive, I think, as I've ever seen him play. But then when he went out there against Gilles, you know, played his standard patterns, spreading the ball wide on the serve, good lefty serve, coming forward, finishing at the net. And Rafa basically regressed. I mean, he backed off.
Yeah, he did. But, I mean, this isn't something that we've never seen from Rafa before. He's played aggressive tennis before, maybe not to the level that we've seen, you know, at the French and then early Wimbledon this year. But there's, and I've talked about this before, certainly in conversations and I think maybe in an article or two, where to me, there's always been a way in which if you came at Rafa with some pace and really went after him, that you could drive him back, and he likes to kind of hang back anyway, but mm-hmm. you could drive him back, and once he starts to get back, the forehand can start to drop a little bit short, and then all of a sudden you can really kind of get on top of him. And you know, Mueller, I mean, yes, he followed his normal patterns, but, I mean, let's be real. His serve is phenomenally good, and he came out and served exceedingly well and took a lot of the initiative away from Rafa. And there's a – I won't say that he didn't really give Rafa much of a choice, but I think on his own service games, Mueller didn't really give Rafa much of a choice. And then once you start to get him on his back foot, there's that – element where I think Rafa starts to play a little more defensively on his own serve, and you know what we get is what we got.
Yeah, well, we've definitely seen from Nadal this way in which he will sort of back off over the years. You know, all the cards on the table. I thought that he, at least to a significant extent, was past that. It seemed like he had a level of commitment to hitting through the forehand and hitting through everything for that matter.
Yeah.
That we've never seen from him. I think, you know, what his response to Mueller shows is that there are still ways that you can really get at him in which he's really uncomfortable. Because the truth is, the guys that were hitting big from the ground before that match, it just wasn't phasing him. And there was a way which, especially I think four or five years ago, and I mean, I shouldn't say it like that. That makes it sound like it wasn't the case over the last year or two, and it has been. But to me, it's just been, especially even 3 years ago, you could really get to Rafa just by hitting big from the baseline. And that didn't look like it was the case either at the French or in the first couple of rounds in London. But Mueller coming forward and really taking good care of his serve, that really, really put Rafa on the back foot, so to speak, even though that's not literal.
Right.
So I think we learned a little something about his psychology there. And kudos to Mueller for sticking with his game and somehow pulling that one out. What, yeah. 15-13 was it in the fifth?
Yeah, I don't know that... I wouldn't say that we learned anything in a sense, because, I mean, this is really just regression to the mean for Rafa. He just did what he's always done, which is, I mean, if we're going to be honest about it, is what most tennis players and people in life tend to do. You know, when things get stressful, people fall back to the things that they know. And that's what we've seen from Rafa in the past, and that's what we saw from Rafa here. To me, it really just comes down to this idea of, if Rafa's going to continue to be a genuine threat at slams, he needs to be more aggressive. I don't think physically he's able to go out and play at the same defensive way that he used to play and expect to do well anywhere other than Paris. And I think if he does play defensively,
all the clay,
but you know, especially when I'm talking just about the slams here, that if he does continue in a more defensive mindset, then it's going to shorten his career. I think it's going to put him in a place where he can't win slams sooner than would happen if he plays more aggressively. So it's really this thing where I think the more aggressively he plays, as long as he's doing so in an intelligent and kind of measured fashion, then he's both going to win more slams and also be able to continue winning slams longer. The question is, can he go against his natural instincts and sustain that when somebody comes at him and takes him out of his groove, makes him uncomfortable, and do that for an entire tournament? And I guess the reality is he doesn't have to. I mean, he's only going to have one or two matches in a slam where somebody's actually going to put that pressure on him. There's only a handful of players who are really capable of doing that.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of guys that play the way that Mueller plays.
No, God. I mean, like I said, the guy has a serve that there's only a... you know, two or three other guys out the tour who actually have a serve that's that good. And then you combine that with his ability to move forward, his willingness to move forward and actually serve and volley and, you know, come in and get to the net and end points. I mean, that's a package that not a lot of guys have. And, you know, we're not going to see that matchup very often. I mean, Rafa, you know, look, in modern tennis the way it is right now, there's only a small handful of guys in the tour who come out and really play that way, that are actually able of able to offer a threat to Rafa, and I think that the odds of him facing any of them on a day when they're playing well at a slam, not that great, you know. I mean, like I said, it might happen once or twice a slam,
even less than that.
And I mean, the thing is, he's still going to win some of those matches, you know, even when he does regress and play more defensively.
Yeah, and to his credit, he stepped up in the third set, and he realized that he was playing in a manner that wasn't going to get it done, and he did start to play much more aggressively.
Right.
But, you know, if you don't know Mueller, if you're not familiar with him, he's the same guy who upset Andy Roddick in the first round of the U.S. Open years ago, back when Andy was a top player and they were running American Express commercials like every 10 seconds. And it was viewed as a big embarrassment, but this was a guy who he literally served Andy Roddick off the court. And basically, he's a big lefty who had a bigger serve than Roddick. Now he's not serving as big as he was in those days. He's not hitting 140, but he's a spot server now, which is much, much better for consistent results. And instead of being a guy that's ranked outside of 100 like he was back then, he's a guy that's ranked in the top 30 now and seems to be improving consistently. So
and look, when we call him a spot server, let's be clear. I mean, it's still a big serve.
Well, he's a spot server at 130 instead of trying to get 145 without control.
Right.
And so it's much better.
I just wanted to be clear about that. Like, it's still a big serve. It's now just a slightly less big serve that's hitting corners, and he's very tough. But, let's not talk about Rafa all day. Let's talk about the part where I was right, you know, where Fed won.
I was just really trying to focus on the part where I was wrong. I didn't want to get to the part where you were right.
Yeah, Federer, I know. I'm going to take that away from you. But, so Federer won. Did so in emphatic stash. Emphatic fashion. That's right, a lot of sounds in two words. Emphatic fashion. And, picked up number 19 and 8 Wimbledons now.
It was easy ever since Rafa lost. I mean, geez.
Widened the gap.
Rafa lost, Novak lost, Murray lost. It was like, I mean, he might as well have been playing out there.
Look, this is tennis. It's survival of the fittest, you know?
I'm just kidding. I hate it when people say
that. Yeah.
He still had to be really good players. And I don't know. I mean, what was the deal with Cilic? Did we ever find out? Was it a blister on his foot?
Yeah,
was
that a blister on the foot. And, you know, I mean, I think that was part of it. I think, to me, it just seemed like he was a little overwhelmed by the occasion. And the blister, no, for real. And I think the blister didn't help. And there's that element, too, for people, and look, we've all been here, where sometimes when we're stuck in a situation, it's less ideal and things aren't going well, and then something happens that gives us a very plausible out, in a sense. It's easy to kind of take that out and just quietly go into the night, you know? And I think there's an element where that happened with Cilic. I think the blister's real. And I also think
the blister's real.
Right, but come on. I mean, I'm just saying. I think the blister was real. And I also think there's an element where, look, I mean, Fed got on top of him early and Cilic was struggling a little bit. And I think that the blister gave him a very, kind of put him in a very difficult psychological situation where he's looking at a long road to try and win that final, and he knows it. And Fed knows it, and that's a tough thing to have sitting there. And the blister just made it, I think, a little bit easy for him to go down quietly.
See, I emphatically disagree with the way that
you phrased it. Of course you do.
And not because we're recording here, but just because I disagree with it. That blister, first of all, the only thing that makes sense to me for any of this is that the blister was already there beforehand.
Yeah.
And he had to be in a lot of pain.
Sure. Okay?
If you look at what the physios that are on the ATP tour do when they have some sort of blister on the foot, I mean, they're basically draining the thing or basically cutting away part of the skin. Some guys leave the skin there. It depends on what the theory and the philosophy is. It's not the first time Cilic has had a blister. I promise he's dealt with this before. But they're going to dry the crap out of it. They're going to put painkiller on there. They're going to put a tape job on there. Like, I mean, they were treating this thing ahead of time and they were managing it. There's no way that it was like just a little blister like you and me would get on the weekend.
No, it was like, huge. I mean, come on. You can find video. You can find pictures. I mean, it was a massive blister. It was under the callus on his foot. I'm not trying to
So he couldn't move. I mean, he's a 6'6", 6'7" guy. Like, he's a huge guy. You take away his movement and make him play Roger Federer on grass, he's going to get waxed.
Well, like, again, I'm not saying that Busta didn't have an impact. I mean, but
it just seems like you're minimizing the impact.
I'm not minimizing it. I'm just saying I think it wasn't the only thing that played a role. I mean, the dude literally sat on center court in the middle of the match and broke down in tears.
Right, and what do you think makes him cry?
Well, look, I'm not the biggest fan of Michael Jordan as a person, as a human being.
Lose any listeners there.
Well, you know, I'm just saying. Like, look, if we go back and look at the history of behavior and the way
we talk about, like, mistreating women and gambling and all the bad stuff,
just mistreating, like, people, right?
Separate it from the.
But let's just set that aside for a minute, okay? Because I'm not here to idolize Michael Jordan, but let's just talk a little bit about mentality for a moment. Because, you know, we can look at Michael Jordan and a certain particular famous playoff performance that he had when sick. You know, the rumors at the time were that it was a flu. I've heard stories since that it was probably food poisoning, that, like, intentional food poisoning. And so the guy's, like, on an IV at halftime, sick as a dog, can barely stand, goes out in the middle of the playoffs and drops 60 on another playoff team. Right?
I'm so happy you're using this example.
And to me, there's just a part where I think some people, when they get in those types of situations, assuming that it's physically possible, use it almost like a fuel to dig deeper and fight harder and find a way to get the job done. I mean, this was one of the greatest basketball performances of Michael Jordan's career, and it happened under those circumstances. It was almost like that adversity unlocked a piece of him that was not typically out there and accessible for him in the middle of matches. Or in the middle of games. And so when I look at Cilic, like, yeah, look, I'm not saying that Blizzard didn't play a role, right? But what I am saying is it seemed to me like very much he rolled over. And I'm not faulting him for that. I think it's a very typical reaction. Look, I like Cilic. I'm a fan of Cilic. By all accounts, he seems to be a great guy. I think he's like a great player. I'm a big fan of his. I just think that, you know, under the circumstances in the occasion, he wilted a little bit. And I think the vast majority of professional athletes probably would have. I mean, there's not a lot of guys out there who have that Michael Jordan mentality.
Glad to hear you say that.
You know, I mean, like, that's a very rare psyche that we're talking about here, and I think it's not a psyche that Cilic has, and that's fine.
So it sounds like you just think that he's just missing that indomitable, competitive, like, I have some psyche that sets me apart and makes me one of the greats in, like, a Jordan, Gretzky, Federer, Tiger Woods.
But here's the thing. It's like, I'm not even sure Tiger Woods has that. I'm not even sure Federer has that. To be honest with you, to go out there and be hurt or injured or sick and play better than normal isn't something that I think most people have.
Let's stop right there, because for all the golf fans out there, they're, like, really upset right now because Tiger Woods won the U.S. Open with a completely demolished knee. Like a torn ACL, and he won the U.S. Open, like, in the tournament. It was, like, unbelievable. So he's the guy whose name gets thrown out with Jordan that I think makes a lot of sense if we buy into this kind of psychological aspect. There's stuff, though, that I think is way, way misleading from this example, okay? First of all, going with the, you know, let's look at Jordan while he was sick in the playoffs. I'm surprised you didn't go with Pete Sampras when he's vomiting on the court, because we have another tennis guy over there.
Well,
the thing though that gets me is when you have that kind of illness, it throws you off in a really serious way, but basically it makes you tired. You get an IV, it helps you in a really significant way, okay? Does it make you 100%? No chance. I'm not saying that. But it's a different kind of problem than I can't push off on my foot because my body won't let me. Now, there are martial arts guys, and I mean, for goodness sakes, for the people that are listening, how many black belts do you have? I don't think we've ever talked about this on the podcast.
Yeah, a couple. I mean,
he's got a couple of black belts, whatever. This guy's a good martial artist that I'm talking to right now, okay? So, I mean, come on, Glenn. Like, we know that there are guys that are fighters that can fight through just about anything. Like, you chop off their arm and they beat you with the stump. But athletes, generally speaking, at this level, don't develop those skills in large part because of what they have to do for a job on a daily basis, because they're focused on developing these unbelievable skills on the tennis court and stuff.
Sure.
But Cilic's movement was impaired. If you put this kind of a blister on Michael Jordan's foot, honestly, I don't think he's going to be able to go out and drop 60 points. I don't think he's going to be able to go out and have that game. That's point number one. And point number two is you're using Michael Jordan as the example, where Michael Jordan was on the other side of the net. Cilic might not have been able to beat you in that final with that blister. And he's got to play Roger Federer. So he needs to go out there and play maybe the best match of his life in order to have a chance to win. He might play the best match of his life and still lose.
Sure.
Because this is Federer at Wimbledon. Now the guy can't move. It's hopeless.
I agree it's hopeless. I'm not saying that he just needed to suck it up and he was going to win that match. My point was, I think there's a degree to where, like I said, I mean, he just kind of packed up and went home. He was physically there, but not really there. And that's fine. I'm not, again, like, you're acting like I'm judging him on coming down on Cilic and saying he's a quitter.
You're not saying that. I'm just saying that the analogy is wrong. Because when Michael Jordan has the flu and goes out and drops 60, or when Tiger Woods wins the U.S. Open on a busted knee, well, guess what? Those guys were better than the field. They were better than everybody else.
Sure. But they also –
So it's a different thing than saying – I mean, that would be like saying Scottie Pippen went into the playoffs and beat Michael Jordan and dropped 60 on him when he had a busted knee. That would impress
the heck out of him. It's about relative performance. I mean, I don't think you're that's entirely fair, because what I'm saying is that Michael Jordan, in a situation where most people would have performed far below their normal capabilities, went out there and found a way to perform above his normally exceptional capabilities, and somehow managed to take it even another level above that while physically impaired. And look, IVs are great. But by all accounts, I mean, the dude had food poisoning, and like, that's not going to put it, he's not coming out there at 100%. And I think you put that blister on the bottom of his foot, it's Michael frickin' Jordan. He's going to find a way to win the bloody game anyway. And maybe he doesn't score 60, but he's still going to be out there, and you're going to see him like fighting with every ounce of his being. And I just didn't see that level of fight from Cilic, and I'm not faulting him for that, because again, like, you're talking about not even just like the top 1% of athletes in terms of the psychological capabilities. I mean, Jordan is a once in a generation of any sport kind of athlete in when it comes to that mental side of things. I don't think Federer compares to Jordan in that regard. I don't compare Tiger to Jordan in that regard. I can't think of another athlete off the top of my head who had that same just indomitable will and drive to win as Jordan. So maybe it's not a fair comparison. My point was just that I feel like there was more fighting to be done than Cilic did. I don't fault him for not finding the way to fight. I mean, again, you're talking to the guy who finds excuses for Nick Kyrgios to act like an ass. Like, there's a lot going into this year. I'm just saying that there was more than just the physical side of it. There's a huge emotional component. I don't think that he fought with every ounce of his being, and that's fine. The final, overall was a bit of a letdown. You know, it's a shame.
Here's what I'll say. This is the last thing I'll say on it. You're right about some of these things that you're saying about Jordan. I think that Cilic played better with this injury to his foot, which isn't a permanent injury, I understand. But I do think it's a very big deal. I don't think Jordan ever had to deal with that kind of thing. And it sounds silly that a blister can be that big of a deal. But Cilic would have played twice as good if he had a broken finger than he would have with this blister under his foot, in my opinion, okay? I think Cilic's level was better than the level we saw from Nishikori when he played Cilic in the final of the U.S. Open.
Okay.
Okay? And to me, that's not so bad. Now, the problem really was the guy that you were playing on the other side of the net. That level wasn't good enough.
Look, I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot Cilic could have done. I mean, Cilic would have to go out and play the match of his life to win, and obviously he wasn't going to do that, and he lost. And I said, I mean, to me, the final was a bit of a letdown. It wasn't really competitive. I don't fault Cilic for that. I mean, it's just crappy circumstances. I think that if he'd been fully healthy and able to bring his best, it would have been a competitive final, but Federer's still probably going to win it. And that's just the way that it is. You know, and I mean, we could hash this out all night probably, but I don't think that's going to be terribly fruitful. So, you know, to a degree, I think we just agree to disagree and we move on. And certainly there's a lot more to talk about because, you know, first of all, we've got Novak Djokovic shut his season down.
Yeah. Speaking of guys that maybe fit into that conversation you just said, that's as far as I'm going to go there. But this guy's got a long, long history of retiring. This is the first time, though, that he's taking time away from the sport. I mean, he's played up until this point 51 straight Grand Slam appearances.
Yeah. And that's look. Like,
that's a lot.
It's a lot of Grand Slams. And I just want to say, too, like, yeah, you know, Djokovic does have a very long history of retiring, and I certainly was not a fan of the way that he used to do that back in the day. But to his credit, I mean, obviously he's done the work, and he's done a fantastic job for a long time now. And so to see him get to a point physically where he has to take, you know, I mean, we're looking at 5-6 months off. I mean, you know, that was really disappointing. Not disappointed in Djokovic, disappointed for him, and disappointed for the sport to you know, have him taken away like this for the rest of the year. I think it's a real shame. But I hope that it's exactly what he needs to get where he needs to be to be a genuine threat at Slams again and play at the level that we know he can. So speaking of which, he's ending his year right now. And in the race, which I think is, you know, for those of you who don't really pay attention to the smaller details of the ranking systems, you know, we've got the year-to-year rankings, which is the number of points that the player has accumulated over the previous 12 months. And then there's the race, which is the number of points they've accumulated since the start of this year. And so in the race right now, the race is looking very interesting, first of all. And we touched on this last time when we were predicting about who's going to finish year in number one. But Novak Djokovic right now is only seventh in the race, which means, I mean, since the beginning of this year, add up everybody's tournament points. Like Djokovic, there are six players who have won more points at tournaments than Djokovic. And he's got 25-85, which if we look at the overall rankings, if we project where that'll put him at the start of next year, because remember, folks, if he's stopping playing, he's not going to win any more points this year. He will likely be somewhere between 13th and 15th in the world when December rolls around.
Which is a little bit crazy to not have to play and be there. But
well,
yeah,
to play for 6 months, yeah.
That's going to be, yeah. I mean, that's going to be really interesting when Melbourne comes around. I mean, just real quick, because I know that we still want to touch on Andy Murray. What do you expect when Novak comes back to the game? Let's assume that he comes back and plays. Let's assume his first tournament back is the Australian Open. Is that?
I would say he'll play one of the lead-ins. I'd be surprised if he didn't. I think maybe he'll play Brisbane he might do Hopman Cup. He'll play something beforehand for sure. Whether it is exhibitions or a full tournament remains to be seen. But I'd be shocked if he just came straight into the Australian Open and just played that right off the bat. But yeah, you know, a lot of it depends on exactly how his relationship with Agassi develops. I mean, Agassi, by the way, has officially signed on for I don't know how long exactly, but for the foreseeable future. To partner with Djokovic and coach/mentor him. So some of this is going to depend exactly what role he takes and how he influences Djokovic and how Djokovic lets him influence him. But to me, here's what I see for Djokovic over the next, you know, let's just say 3 to 5 years, depending on how long he really wants to keep playing. Because he's 30 now. I don't see Djokovic as being one of these guys who's going to be out there on the tour when he's 35, maybe 35, but certainly... I mean, I think he's going to retire age-wise before Federer does. As in, you know, like Federer might be playing when he's 37, and Djokovic might retire at 35.
Federer's going to go to 43. Novak will retire when he's 34.
But so, what I when I look forward over the next few years for him, I don't think that we're ever going to see Djokovic dominant the way that he was, you know, 18 months ago, 2 years ago. He's had basically 3 years of incredible dominance. But, yeah. You know, the 2011 season, period, and then obviously a few years gap, and then he kind of got it all figured out again. And you know, like 2015, 2016, with both obviously phenomenal years for him. Not obviously the end of 2016 so much, but I don't see him ever really reaching that level again. I think that the things that he's gone through over the last year and a half, 2 years, where, you know, I've talked before about how he's lost a lot of muscle mass and the impact that's had on his game. And look, people love to talk about how nice Novak Djokovic's backhand is. And look, it's a great backhand. It's very clean. What people don't talk enough about is the fact that if he is 5% less of a good mover, as in if you reduce his movement, his quality and speed and endurance by 5%, he is nowhere near the level of player. His backhand suddenly isn't anywhere near as good. I think a lot of people out there who have technically better backhands than Djokovic, but their movement is, he's just so far above and beyond everybody else when it comes to the lateral movement that it's made that stroke look better than it really is. His forehand's good, but his forehand is not, you know, Del Potro or Federer. It's not one of the great forehands of the game. His serve is not a dominant serve. He can't come out and serve like Gilles Muller. I mean, like he's a very poor volleyer for the level of player that he is, and his overhead is abysmal. So when I know, right? I'm just gonna tell you how I really feel. I'm not gonna hold back here.
But his overhead's pretty good, right?
No, it's terrible. It's beyond terrible. I just want to say this. Like, I'm not saying this like to rag on Novak Djokovic. I think the fact that he was able to go out and play tennis at the level that the things that he did well, which were lateral movement, you know, in terms of the speed of it and the ability to sustain it, just shot after shot after shot after shot for hours at a time, and his discipline and his willingness to stick to the game plan and be very selective about when he comes forward and to just pure sheer will his way through matches, I've got a profound amount of respect for the work ethic and the discipline that Djokovic has brought to the table in order to accomplish everything that he's accomplished. But he is far from a complete player. This is not a guy who can do what Federer has done right now and said, you know what, I'm just going to come to the net more and I'm just going to keep improving my serve and I'm going to smack a bunch of aces and get some serve volley in and chip and charge more and just, you know, like just do all these. That's not in the cards for Djokovic. That's not in the cards for him. He can't do that.
That's why Fed has 19 slams and Novak has less than 19, but still a whole lot.
Right. So Djokovic doesn't have – his plan B is to do his plan A better. And again, I don't mean that as criticism, but the reality is when we start looking forward for him and the fact that this injury that he has is not going to exactly help him regain his level of fitness and his muscle mass that he's lost, you know, and the level of emotional output he has to have in order to be as disciplined as he was. And we've talked about this and, you know, he's married now. Like, he's not sleeping in hyperbaric chambers every night. And if he is, he's probably not going to stay married that long. I just don't see a scenario where he's able to come out physically be at the level that he was at. What I do think, but this is the thing, this is not to say that he can't be number one again. This isn't to say that he can't win slams. I think he's capable of doing both of those things. He's just going to have to do it in a different way. And Agassi is the type of person who I think can show him a way to be more balanced in his life and have a more holistic approach to things where it's not always about tennis every moment of every day and be able to play at a high level, high enough to win slams, high enough to be number one. And so when I look forward to finally answer your actual question, when I look forward to January and the Australian Open.
I don't even remember my question.
Well, So when I look forward, you asked me what I saw for him in January, you know, when the Australian Open rolls around. Yeah, that question, it was like 10 minutes ago. What I see for him is this. I see him coming out and playing very well. I see him rolling through early rounds. I see him making at least the quarters, probably the semis, maybe the finals. I think winning the tournament isn't out of the question for him. It's not going to be a steamroll. He's not going to just like blow his way through the draw unless something changes in the next few months with the other players that I don't know about, you know, injuries to Rafa or Fed or and or all of them. But he's going to be a force, but it's going to be a much more balanced kind of top 3-4 than it was when he was dominating. And, you know, we're not going to see him at the level that he was 2 years ago.
Okay.
That's what I see. How about you?
Well, nice handoff.
Thank you. I know, right? Very eloquent. I was very sure.
That was a regular rugby handoff right there.
Yep.
So I think I want to start by mentioning that there's, I think, a very real possibility that isn't being talked about a lot, at least in the media stuff that I'm reading and in the circles even that I'm running, that Novak is really taking a play out of Federer's book right here. And I'm sure somebody must have written about this, and I apologize for missing it to whoever it is. But, you know, I mean, Fed took off however many months it was, skipped the French, everyone's telling him, you know, well, that was the year, you know, last year. And then then he took off more time, skipped the French to prep for Wimbledon. And
skipped the entire clay court season, yeah.
Yeah, and people were just slamming him. You can't skip the clay. What are you doing? You can't just take this time off, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? You know, it turns out that these guys actually are pretty good at practicing. That's how they got this good in the first place, FYI. They weren't just born at this level. I hate to burst everyone's bubble. And taking that time off and dedicating themselves to preparing for very particular things works very, very well. So there's a good chance that Novak is just saying, you know, all this crap is going on, whatever it is. And a little bit of, hey, screw this. I'm going to do what that guy did. Get everything sorted and get straight. And I'm just going to come back and be better than ever. Now, I don't know that he can really do that, but I want to lead that into what you said about Andre, about taking a holistic approach and bringing some of his, oh man, how did you refer to it?
Balance, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say some of his off-court life into a coherent place with what he's trying to do as far as his legacy in tennis goes. And I think it's worth noting that Andre may be the first person to really have a combination here, and it's important that it's a combination of two things. One is a significant place in Novak's life where he has like influence and impact, and two is a level of authority, right? Mm-hmm. That will give that influence more authority than just being good, sound advice. Because I'm sure good people have given Novak good, sound advice in the past. But Andre might be the first guy who really believes in Novak in this position where he accepts him. I mean, he sees the flaws. And I think Andre's the kind of guy who can just say, yeah, like, do you know about the stuff that I was doing when I was only a couple years younger than you? Like, you know, it doesn't mean you're a bad person forever. It doesn't mean that you're hopeless at all. Like, this is just what we go through as human beings.
Sure.
You know, let's get out there and let's get to work and have a good time. And, you know, if that's really the case, the power of that, I think, can't be overstated. So it's going to be really interesting to see what goes on there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's got. I'm happy for Djokovic that he's found Agassi, or convinced Agassi to come his way. You know, I mean, I think it's a great thing for him as a person. And I really would love to see him, you know, come out and do things in a balanced way and be competitive against slams. I mean, I think this year has been incredibly exciting for tennis. I mean, it's been incredibly exciting for tennis, and I think that if Djokovic can get it together a little bit and come back and, you know, Murray can get some rest and come back. And you've got TM up and coming and playing really well. I mean, he's number 3 in the points race right now. Zverev obviously having an impact. I mean, yeah. Stan, I mean, he's going to be floating around, smacking backhands till the end of time.
He's going to keep improving.
Yeah. You know, my boy Grigor is slowly coming up.
Yeah, he's still got 6 or 7 more slams to win.
Yeah. You know, I just look at all this and I just think that we really have a convergence of 3 different tennis generations potentially all playing great tennis at the same time.
Hey, that's a great point, actually. I haven't heard anyone make that. And that's exactly right. There's it's this might be the first time. That's probably silly. I'm not old enough to know.
No, this is going to be the first time pretty much, because when you think about the age at which players traditionally retired.
Yeah, but back in the day, I mean, go back to like Laver Ash, where Ash is like 33,
yeah, I just can't.
Laver,
I'm sorry.
Like 37,
like,
and there's guys that
look,
are 22 years old coming up.
I love those guys. I have the world respect for them, but come on, we can't compare that to the modern game and the physical demands of the modern game.
No, of course it's not. But I'm saying what I was going to say was that this is the first time that we've had three generations of champions playing at the same time. But I think this is actually the second time. What's interesting is I think we haven't had that since whatever time period that was, when Laver would have been about 37, 38 years old.
Yeah. Well, the only way that I could be wrong about that, now that I think about it, is if we go back 20 years, maybe a little more than that, we go back to the 80s and 90s, we had a lot of the guys that were going to be big breaking through in their, like, teens. I mean, Becker won Wimbledon, he was 17 years old.
Right.
And so in that generation, we might be able to go back and look through, and I have to probably actually look at that. But when you had Becker coming through, winning Wimbledon, at that point,
Zverev as a teenager now, and Federer just winning a slam at 34.
Right. No, for sure. Well, Zverev is now 20 years old, by the way. He's no longer a teenager. But yeah, I mean, we've got a legit 15-year age gap between, Federer and Zverev. I mean, that's pretty serious, obviously. I'm just trying to think, like, if Becker was 17, that's when we were looking at a 32-year-old in that same
No 32-year-old that was slams. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there were guys that were still playing, and there were guys that were still very good. But
not many at that point either. I mean, not many. Most of them had retired. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a really – but to me, more importantly, is, I mean, you've got, like, it's not just, like one 35-year-old and one 30-year-old and one 25-year-old, one 20-year-old. We've got this whole – I mean, you look at the names. You've got, like Murray, Nadal, Federer, Wawrinka, Djokovic, Cilic, Tim, Zverev. Like, there's just this slew of names that are all going to be great – or already are going to be great players. And throw Kyrgios in there. It's just an incredibly exciting time to be a fan of tennis, and I really hope that the ATP can do a good job. And the Slams, good job of marketing
these guys, yeah.
Yeah, and really making the story of these up-and-coming generations something that's compelling for people to keep them engaged or get them engaged in the sport.
Well, it's a great time. I mean, the level of tennis has never been higher. It keeps getting better. It's pretty awesome. The guys are more and more committed to it. It's pretty great. I mean, you're right to be grateful. So,
yeah, just like I was right about Federer.
Oh God, I know you were right about Federer, but I mean, let's guys go listen to that Dimitrov podcast from a while back.
Hey, jury's still out on that. Don't be like that. Do not be like that.
Just came back from 2 weeks of surfing in Costa Rica, or you want me to just take it easy on you? Come on.
Yeah,
man.
A little bit. I'm still easing my way back into civilization. Thank you very much. Well, not civilization, but like working life. So do we need to talk about Murray? I mean, really, is there a lot to say other than Murray, go get some bloody rest?
Nah, I don't think rest is the problem. I really think the problem is his forehand.
Well, look, but that's okay. Why just stop at the forehand?
No, okay, look, that wasn't a dig at Murray. That was very much a comment from being like a biomechanics guy, where his forehand is causing him hip problems, and his hip is actually a problem. And
yeah,
like you and I both know the real problem with Murray having a little bit of a developing hip issue, it's not that his injury is so bad, because it's not so bad. If he was just like an average guy in average life, he wouldn't even care about this injury.
Right. But when you're a guy who moves for a living and your movement gets a little bit impaired, that's a problem.
You talked about 5% from Novak Djokovic. If Andy Murray has this hip problem get any worse, then he's losing 10% of his game. He's losing 10 miles an hour on his average ground stroke. He is dropping a level as a tennis player.
Yeah, and actually, this just brings me back to an interesting point about Federer, because, if we compare Federer's movement now to Federer's movement in, 2006, 2007, whatever, I mean, the guy has lost 5% of his movement, maybe 10% of his movement, but he's, because of the completeness of his game, and especially because of that serve, that beautiful, ridiculous serve, you know, he's still able to be competitive. Like, he's found ways to work around that.
There was a time when you couldn't hit a winner on Roger Federer.
Yeah, I mean, forget
about it. Remember, like, people, like, put yourself back in that place if you're listening. There was a time when literally guys on the tour were like, well, you can't hit a winner on the guy. You have to make him miss a backhand. That was like your only chance for winning a point.
Yeah, and unless you were rough on clay, then it was always just make him miss a backhand.
Make him miss a backhand.
Yeah, but point being that I bring this up not because I just want to rant about Roger Federer, but when you look at Murray and you look at Djokovic, and even when you look at Rafa to a degree, these guys, Rafa has, I think, maybe the next most complete game on the tour behind Roger, and only by a small margin. Rafa's net game is impeccable.
Just his serve isn't as good. I mean,
yeah. So I mean, that's really it. It's just his serve isn't as good.
Everything else.
I mean, I think his overhead compares, which is a huge statement. But I mean, his overhead is fantastic. His volleys are great. But you know, Murray doesn't quite. I mean, I think Murray's a very tidy volleyer, but he's not quite as sharp as the other two, and his serve is, you know, definitely not as good. And then you look at Djokovic. I mean, obviously the net game's lacking, and the serve is lacking. These guys don't have the ability to adapt to the same degree, and that's going to be very important as we look over the next 2 to 3 years at what happens to them physically and their ability to sustain training and sustain the level of movement that they have had. That's been such a critical part of them having the success that they've had. I just think it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens to them, you know, as they start to age a little more.
Yeah, true. And
I don't know where I was going with that, but I just felt like that needed to be said.
But either, but it just, you know, the other thing that you've got to look at is the guys that are coming up. I mean, I'm at this, you know, dinky little challenger. Maybe I shouldn't talk about Lexington that way, but I'm at a small 75K challenger.
A glorious challenger at Lexington.
Well, I mean, the tournament's well run, and it's like the competition is great. You know, and the players are good. It's a 75K tournament as opposed to a tour event. So I think we're allowed to refer to it on the dinky side. But I mean, these guys that are coming up, I mean, the level is just so much, so much higher than what it was a decade ago. There's a clear jump. I mean, everybody is much more well-rounded. Everybody can hit so much better off of both sides from the ground, and everybody can serve big.
Yeah, so, I mean, the game's evolved, you know?
The game's evolving, and that's the other thing. I mean, as these guys clearly are continuing to develop their skills well into their 30s, but their movement's starting to take a hit. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and what sort of balance that gives the game. It seems like some of the old guys are going to have to really, really focus more on tactical tennis.
Haha, I see what you did there.
Well, it's folks, the first time. Do you believe we've made it this far and it's the first time that either one of us has done that?
Made a tactical tennis pun? Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, I'm impressed, especially given how tired you are.
You should probably edit that out.
I'll think about it. I think it's probably going to stay in. I don't know if I'm going to edit anything out from this one. But yeah, it ended up being a long one. But folks, we'd love to hear from you as always. We've had some great emails, obviously not the last 2 weeks because I was off serving and Jake's me off coaching and we haven't done a podcast in a little while. But if you do have comments or questions or suggestions for something to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at Glenn with one N, GLEN at tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com.
Follow us on Facebook, and again, go to the website, not just because it's great. We think it's great. We're trying to make it great. But because if you sign up there, put your email in, you will get in the running to win some prizes. I know I keep mentioning this, but we're launching, you know, a rebuild of the website, and it's coming any day now. And as a part of that, we're going to give some stuff away. So, you know, if you get your email in there, you increase your chance of winning from no chance of winning to a chance of winning. So that's an infinite increase in winning percentages if you go from not entered to entered. So go ahead and sign up on the website. If you do that, just please check your spam mail for the confirmation, because you have to confirm, because we're not interested in spamming people. So on that note, have a great day and look forward to hearing from you folks.
Peace out.